Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with historian Dr. Gordon Nick Mueller, President and CEO Emeritus of the National World War II Museum. He'll be talking about the new book, Everything We Had, D-Day 6644. It's a great pleasure to welcome Gordon H. Nick Mueller to The Reading Life. He served 17 years as the National World War II Museum's founding president and CEO, and he's celebrating that achievement with a new book, Everything We Had, D-Day 6644, and it is a beauty. Nick Mueller, I'm so happy to have you here.
Happy to be back in my old haunts here.
Exactly. This is a homecoming for you.
It is indeed.
You are a history professor here. Vice Chancellor, started Metropolitan College, the UNO Research Park. Really?
Making me tired to think about it.
I know. Most of all, it's where you and Steve Ambrose met.
That's right. We did, 1971. I helped recruit him to university, and we became fast friends, the best friend I had in New Orleans, and that lasted up until his death.
And I love the way he wrote about your friendship and comrades, which was such a lovely book, wasn't it?
That book was my idea, but not for the part he wrote about me, because that wasn't written at the time. It was because of the essay he had done for the Monticello Society on the friendship of Lewis and Clark.
Right.
And I thought that was such a lyrical, wonderful piece. I said, why don't you expand stories like that? And his publisher said, well, why don't you, it's a good idea, why don't you add some other stories of great friendships, and like Eisenhower and Patton and others. And then he got into autobiographical stuff. I said, oh, Steve. I said, he said, yeah, I didn't want to do that stuff, but they made me.
So you can imitate him pretty well, too. Now, I just think it's so wonderful that the whole museum sprang from this conversation in a backyard, two friends sitting there imagining what might possibly come of scholarly work.
Boy, it was our Hewlett-Packard moment for sure.
It was.
We didn't know what we were getting into. We had no clue how big this could be. Steve and I had drinks in his backyard every afternoon. About five, he was lucky to still be teaching, and I was wailing away at trying to get the research part going. So get there about 5 o'clock, and he'd pull out some cheap sherry and we'd scheme our next big project. But that was the day he said, you've got this park, you got to develop. It's university land now. And he said, we've been talking about a museum for D-Day or World War II in Washington or somewhere. But he said, they're never going to do it. You've got the land where Higgins tested the landing craft over there. So I'm going to give you all my oral histories about 1,000 of them at that time that he'd collected for the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and a book he was going to put out in 1994. And he says, I'll give you all those oral histories, and you go out and build a D-Day museum right there on the spot where they were tested. And you raise the money, and I'll give you the oral history.
Right.
That's no deal, Ambrose. I said, you know, we've always done everything we've schemed about together, and this is no exception. Besides that, you've got the big name and the big rep and the books to help raise the money. He said, okay, it's only going to be $1 million. And I said, well, that's another place you're really dumb. I said, it's going to be at least $4 million.
and even then.
We were both so naive and had no idea what we were getting into, but we plugged away at it. And 10 years later, and about 25 million later, we were downtown in the warehouse district instead of on the lakefront. And that's part of the story of a future book.
And D-Day has always been at the heart of this museum. I remember when Steve was writing his books and we were talking about his plans for his work, and he said, the D-Day book will come and then there'll be the museum and that will be the culmination. I mean, if you think about it, we talk about literary landmarks here all the time, but the National World War II Museum is one of the great literary landmarks of New Orleans. We're
Indeed
talking about writers who
yeah.
who literally changed the face of the city.
Yeah.
So pats on the back.
Well, I think the pats go to a lot of people on our board, of course, to Steve Ambrose, to a great staff, friends and donors from all across the country eventually that that understood the importance of the mission and importance of having a great national museum to tell a big national story that is really as important to our history as the founding of our country in the American Revolution, the Civil War for the 19th century. It's World War II in the 20th century, and it defined America's character based on principles that we had long held dear. But this was a war like no other war in human history.
Right.
And both in its destructiveness and its scope and its technology, atomic energy, 65 million people killed, two-thirds of them civilians. I mean, it was a horrific conflict. And we have a point of view. We believe America and the American spirit made a difference. And we get some criticism for that a little bit, but we don't go overboard into triumphalism. We try to tell the story, and we do tell it from an American point of view with the best historians, the best documents, authentic photographs, film,
and the great continued discussion that happens there.
And continue the discussion. And we go into every dimension of the war in our conferences and symposia, programs, online courses that we're developing. And so we're just at the beginning of that part. You know, the brick and mortar is getting finished, and now we're on to pushing the boundaries of the museum all across the globe.
So is that part of your goal for this book, that you get this wonderful representation of some of the museum's important holdings out there for people to look at and take home?
Yes, that was a part of it. It's really kind of coming full circle when you think that the oral histories that Steve was collecting for a book on D-Day starting in 1985. By 1990, that idea had grown to not just a book, but a museum. But it began with personal accounts, which Stephen deserves all the credit in the world. Ambrose is the one who first started mining those oral histories throughout D-Day first and then the rest of the war. And he knew they were valuable. They had to be preserved for future generations.
Knew he was racing against time.
Yes.
He felt this real sense of urgency.
They were leaving us, and he said that so many times. And so now here we are almost 20 years since that backyard conversation, and I was stepping down in 2017 in the summer and getting ready to write the museum history. But we were planning for the 75th anniversary of D-Day to make that a big commemoration event, to take part of it in Normandy. And we have two ships going with 1,000 people and historians. And I said to my successor, you know, I think the museum needs a commemorative book. And why don't we do something that pulls out the personal accounts? We now have 10,000 oral histories, most of them on video. I said, why don't we do something that brings those stories, our collections, our photographs, and all of that into a book on D-Day? And I wanted to focus on 24 hours of their story from midnight to midnight on D-Day. I mean, the transcripts of our oral histories might go on for 20, 30, 40 pages. One with Dick Winter is almost 300 pages. So we had to slice out those pages of the personal accounts that just began there. Now, in a few cases, we drift beyond the D-Day to June 7 or 8 because the story for that person doesn't quite end on D-Day in the most dramatic part. But that was the nub of the idea. We were going to produce it ourselves, and then Carlton publishers called from London and asked Steve Watson, the then successor president CEO, what are y'all doing for the 75th anniversary of D-Day? He said, well, funny you should ask, because Nick Mueller wants to do a book on our oral histories, and we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we'd like to publish it. So that's how it got going.
So thanks a lot.
Well, it took that. It was a one excruciating deadline, because by the time we had the contract signed, we only had about 6-7 months to write the introductions and collect it and curate it and get all 150 photographs, et cetera.
Well, these are always a labor of love. One of the things that struck me looking at this book was how important it was to these men to leave the written record. I love that Eisenhower writes that note in his own hand saying, you know, whatever happens today, it's my responsibility. Asa Clark writes on this bomb tag, the big show is on.
Right.
And then John Capehart has his comrades sign a parachute silk. Those are very moving to see in this book. You know what I mean?
Because absolutely,
their survival, their fragility as objects.
Right. And they were aware, you can tell from reading this book, that they were involved in something really big mm-hmm. and important. There's so many of them that were in the planes crossing the English Channel with the paratroopers right after midnight, who looked down on that vast armada of some 5,000 ships and boats. And just it was just staggering. 700 planes just in the armada of planes going with the paratroopers. And so they wrote things in their Bibles, the yeah. tags on the bombs. They left a record. And certainly the generals and the leaders kept diaries and notes and wrote a lot. They knew they were a part of history. And for an 18-year-old, that's
yeah.
pretty heady stuff, you know. They were afraid. In many cases, as they crossed the channel in ships and planes, they were writing the last letters to their mothers or fathers
right.
or wives. They were talking in a very simple language, reflecting, I think, the values of mm-hmm. of kids at that time. I mean, these were kids. They should have been at their senior prom, and they were going into one of the biggest battles in world history.
But that's one of the things that comes through from the wonderful selections you've made, because you tell us how old they are. Time and time again, it hits home how very young they were. And you also demonstrate what a great cross-section of the country mm-hmm. was included in that fighting force.
Yeah, these kids came from everywhere.
Yeah.
And so we do not just use their, you know, a couple thousand words of their story on D-Day, but we tell you a little bit about them beforehand, and we tell you what happened to them at the end after the war and where they went and when they went back home. Just not a lot, but you find out if their war ended like Hal Baumgarten on June 7 with 5 wounds, and
right.
that was the end of the war for him, and Ed Tipper with Airborne, and he went out on the 9th, and his comrades all thought he was dead. So there are funny anecdotes in there, too,
yeah, there
and
are.
Humorous moments. But it's it gets you inside the boats, the planes, and inside the minds mm-hmm. of these young people, and so it's quite extraordinary for me just to read them.
And you've chosen such beautiful human things to include in this book. I mean, you look at a paratrooper's boots, mm-hmm. or a leather jacket, or an embroidered patch. I mean, what is it like for you to walk through the museum and see those things that people have given to you?
Oh, it's always a thrill. You know, I walk around today and I kind of pinch myself, say, how did this all happen?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, despite the epic nature of the museum and its physicality and what got us at the beginning still is the most powerful, and those are the personal artifacts, the personal stories. And so from the beginning, Steve Ambrose always insisted, we're just not going to have 25 helmets on the wall. We're
right.
going to have the helmet that's got a hole in it and a story behind that. How did the soldier tell us? So it links up In fact, that's exactly what he said when we had that backyard conversation. You know, these stories I'm giving you are tremendous because these oral histories are connected to artifacts these guys sent me. You know, mm-hmm. they said, Doc, you can have this knife out of mine. And,
right.
You can have this boot with the hole in it, and this is how that happened. And so it links the physical material artifact with that individual, and it takes you down to the human side of war, mm-hmm. the face of war.
There's nothing like a pair of shoes to do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Shoes are such individual things.
That's right. And we want people to feel like they're walking in those shoes.
Right.
When they go ashore in Omaha and Utah, or climb the cliffs of Pointe Hawk, mm-hmm. or parachute out of planes and land in either water or land. They didn't know where. It was pitch black. So it was it's quite something to think about.
Well, some of these narratives, I mean, all of them are quite brief and readable in that perfect choice mm-hmm. of length. But some of these are people we've come to know because of the museum. People like Dick Winters, for mm-hmm. example, who is in this book as well.
Yep. Yeah, with Dick Winters, kind of interesting. Is we broke away from the personal narrative excerpt from the veterans to use an interview that Steve Ambrose had with Dick Winters about the taking of the town of Carentan on June 9th. So that's one of those cases where we went beyond, and it's just their discussion as Steve is getting ready to write his book, Band of Brothers, and he's trying to track the movement of Easy Company under Dick Winters' command, and you can read they're talking on the with a map and pointing to different places that that the company Easy Company went to as they penetrated the Carentan. And it's just great. I mean, there's Dick Winters said, we were all in ditches and the firing started and I had to run down the road kicking them in the ass, telling them,
right.
get going, get up. And they, and of course, his leadership, they all jumped out of the ditches and followed him. And it was a ferocious fight ahead of them. But it gets you inside that story. And that's pretty cool.
Oh, and no one can read this book without feeling wet. I mean, it's just like you feel like you're drowning in the water when
yep.
you get off the boat.
Yep.
That common experience is yep. really, it mm-hmm. really comes home to you. Now, there's some things that language kind of strains for when you're telling a story like this. And I want to ask you to read for us that wonderful quote from Howard Vanderbeek, who's the naval officer describing what he felt during D-Day, if you don't mind, because that was one of my favorite parts.
Okay, well, if you'll give it to me, I'll be glad to read it.
I will indeed.
Well, this passage was selected even before the, or right after the title page of the book.
So,
with the Higgins landing craft and the guys going ashore on the left side of the page. And Vanderbeek says this, "The English language does not provide a multifaceted, exact word that alone can describe which surely must have been surging through each man's mind and body. Were such a word to be coined, it would include meanings embodied in such interrelated words as bravery, weakness, trust, toughness, uncertainty, love, tenacity, determination, despair, fearlessness, fright, faith, assurance, doubt, hate, loyalty, distrust, resolution, seriousness, prayerfulness, bravado, and hope."
And hope.
That's pretty such powerful stuff.
It's beautiful. Yep. It's beautiful. Thank you for reading it for us. So tell us what's next for you. Retirement is looking pretty busy, as you said.
It has been. You know, I'm supposed to only be working 3/4 time. I haven't gotten down to that yet. But I have a small research staff. And by the way, I just should mention Coleman Warner, who's my sort of chief of staff here, and Kaylee Martin, a master's student in public history from our history department at UNO. Both were just tremendous in helping to pull this book together and meeting the deadlines. And we had to produce 12 magnificent maps by the same map maker that does the maps for the West Point books.
Oh, they are wonderful maps.
They're great. And they illuminate every story and every beachhead and beach assault. And also had to get all the oral histories transcribed and curate the photographs and the artifacts that were going to be photographed and included in the book. So that my staff helped with that book, and they're going to help me with the next one too, and collecting the materials for my next project, which is to write the museum history. And it's not just how we built the museum. That's all part of it, and raised the money and built the board and all the things you have to do. But it's also a story about how I and Stephen Ambrose, in the outset and in later board members, began to recognize and try to understand how to portray this conflict in a compressed form. Mm-hmm. In a museum, it's hard writing a book. It's even harder compressing World War II inside of exhibits,
of course,
and to make it comprehensible and to realize that you are the caretakers of national memory,
right,
on the biggest event in world history. I mean, that's sobering stuff. So the story about the museum history is also not only my intellectual journey through the war and how to tell it, but it's a story that is interesting from the ups and downs of what went on, the setbacks, going broke a couple times, Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
So there's all that, but the larger story is the arc of America's journey through the war and how to tell it.
One of the things that I think is so wonderful about the museum is that by its very nature, from the very beginning, it has been so inclusive, and people feel honored and want to give things to the museum. People want to have a brick on that plaza. They want to be part of this. And I think that's a remarkable result of your spirit and your sense of how important this stewardship really is to people.
That's right. And Steve's too. We always felt like we were going to build this museum the same way America won World War II. And that's with all of us in it together. And that meant giving everybody a piece of the rock if we could. In the early years and in the down years, there were times when some of our board members and others wanted to throw in the towel. Certainly after Katrina, that was a viable option for many. And our leadership, but people became invested in this, not just me, but board members and donors and staff and 165,000 members around the country. You know,
right.
It's twice the size of the largest museum membership of any museum in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art, I think, is around 80,000.
That's impressive.
Think about that. And all those people feel like they're charter members and they're helping. It might be $25 or $50, but it all got us to the goal line.
That was something to really be proud of. We've been talking with Nick Mueller, who's the former president and CEO of the National World War II Museum. You can meet him at the book launch party for Everything We Have, D-Day 6644, Thursday, March 14th at the Louisiana Memorial Pavilion at the museum, 945 Magazine Street. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, and we look for all of the audience out here at WWNO to be down there on that day.
All right.
All
thanks
right.
Again. You better come back.
Okay. I will.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? Here in New Orleans, the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society presents Meet the Author, with Thomas Mallon, author of Landfall, Maurice Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow, and Roger Kamenetz, author of Yonder, Sunday, March 10th from 2 to 4 at the Cabildo. Free, but RSVP to falkhouse@aol.com. Ken Wells discusses and signs Gumbo Life, Tales from the Rue Bayou. Monday, March 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. There will be readings by poets Andrea Young, Khalid Hagazi, Jessica Bordelon-Machel, Dennis Formento, Jonathan Penton, and Paul Catafago, and a performance by No Frets, celebrating the life and work of poet Mahmoud Darwish. Monday, March 11th from 7 to 9 at the Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge's new location, 6621 St. Claude Avenue in Araby. Four featured writers perform in the Why There Are Words series first quarterly reading, Wednesday, March 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The theme is transformation, and the featured writers are Allison Alsup, Randy Bates, Julia Carey, Vincent Salucci, Lady Hubbard, and Mark Yakich. The event is curated and emceed by Liz Green, with a suggested donation at the door. Jesse Morgan Owens discusses and signs Girl in Black and White, the story of Mary Mildred Williams and the abolition movement, Wednesday, March 13th at 7:30 at the Dogfish Reading Series at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Dr. Gordon Nick Mueller, founder and president of the CEO National World War II Museum, discusses and signs Everything We Had, D-Day 6644. Thursday, March 14th at the Louisiana Memorial Pavilion at the museum, 945 Magazine Street. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Mac Barnett signs his illustrated children's book, Circle, Thursday, March 14th at 4 at Octavia Books. Maxine Gordon appears with Fred Kasten to discuss and sign Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon, Thursday, March 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their big book sale March 14th through 17th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 8 and Sunday from noon to 5. Best-selling authors Danielle Clayton, author of the Bells series, and COO of We Need Diverse Books, and Zoraida Cordova, author of the Brooklyn Brujas series and the Vicious Deep trilogy, will hold teen chats at Jefferson Parish Libraries on Saturday, March 16th. The first is from 11 to 1 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The second is from 2 to 4 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. The Poetry Buffet features Jack Bedell, Ray Ball, and Karen Massera, hosted by Gina Ferrara, Saturday, March 16th at 2 at the Ladder Library. And get ready for that big literary weekend in New Orleans, March 27th through 31st, when the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival takes place, along with the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival at the Hotel Monteleon. Some of the writers on the schedule are Dorothy Allison, Jamie Attenberg, Brian Batt, Donna Brazile, Doug Brinkley, Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, Samantha Downing, Judy Gron, Garth Greenwell, Justin Philip Reed, Felice Picano, and Brian Washington. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net or SASFest.org for the complete schedule. In Baton Rouge, best-selling author Greg Iles discusses and signs his new novel, Cemetery Road, Friday, March 15th at 6 at Barnes & Noble, City Place. The Delta Mouth Literary Festival takes place April 5th through 7th at LSU. The festival this year features Joss Charles, Tia Clark, Jerrica Marchand, Megan McDowell, Carrie Messenger, Theory Mint, Dennis James Sweeney, and Jeannie Venosco. Check out deltamouth.com for the complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.